Ulrich is a chain-smoking, tough-as-nails investigative journalist for the New York City newspaper, The Daily Bugle. Lois Lane is an award-winning, tough-as-nails reporter for the Metropolis newspaper, The Daily Planet. Chris Hoffman is not. He's the guy we got on a podcast. It's time for the Lane Ulrich Report with extra special correspondent, Chris Hoffman.
Hello and welcome to the Lane Ulrich Report. I'm Chris Hoffman, indie comic book creator and co-founder of Validity Studios. Today, my guest is Greg Boucher, indie comic book creator from Studio Stella Polaris. His comics include Slave, True North, and the various Weird Western Adventures series. Based out of Las Vegas, Nevada, he's been creating comics for 19 years, and he's so good that Tom King can read his mind and produce replicas of panels Greg has created but not published yet, allegedly. Greg, thanks for taking the time to hang out with me today and talk comics.
Howdy. Thanks for having me on.
So we met each other actually at a convention. We were at I was at the Las Vegas Awesome Convention at the Las Vegas Convention Center, which is actually one of my favorite conventions. And that's your home convention, yeah?
Yeah. It's kind of our base of operations. We do a lot for Amazing Las Vegas Comic Con and for Vegas Valley Comic Book Festival. Those are our two like big ones here in town. We just had another one start up last year, and we're kind of trying to get that going. It's called Unicon, and that's coming up in a few weeks, but we can get into that a little bit later.
Awesome. No, that sounds great. Yeah, we're certainly going to talk conventions because there's a new article that came out that I want to talk about. I've been hearing a lot of chat. New York Comic Con was this last weekend, and I saw some posts and whatnot about that. So I do want to talk about that as well. But before that, let's talk about your comics. And so I mentioned out of there, Slave and Weird one of the Weird Western Adventures was my introduction to your comics. Kindred Spirit at the Comic Con, wanted to make sure that was also, I'm also a huge fan of going to the conventions and finding indie comic creators and grabbing their books. So like, start from the beginning, like what got you into comics in the first place?
So when I was in middle school, back in the, God, it was actually before that, back in the old Marvel Cards days, 90, 91, we started getting really into comics. It was elementary school for me. And then I met this kid, Keith, he was a year or two older than me, and we started writing and drawing our own comics. And I mean, they were pretty rudimentary, just a couple pages stapled together, and everything was hand-drawn, hand-lettered. Did some crossovers, you know, a lot of little kid stuff. And then about 2003, I decided I wanted to start writing a superhero book. I mean, we all do eventually want to write a superhero book. That's kind of what draws so many people to comics, our four-colored adventures of superheroes. So I decided I wanted to create a new comic with a character that I had been running out of, like some Heroes RPG games, named Alexander, after Alexander the Great. He was kind of like somewhere between Wolverine and Spider-Man. I know, pretty basic stuff and character that I had been kicking around since I was like 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And I decided to start writing about him. And as I was writing about him, I kind of would lose interest, come back to it, lose interest, come back to it. And then in 2004, my dad ended up dying, and I didn't really have a good way to process the grief. So I started writing about the grief through the character. I put the character into my situation and started telling my story that way, because I thought if I could bring this story to the world, maybe it would help somebody else that was where I was. Mm-hmm. And I wrote all the way through 20 issues of that series. And then I started working on something kind of different. I didn't necessarily get the catharsis I needed, but it was helpful. Eventually, though, I got to the point where I was kind of ashamed of that series, some of the things that I had written. I wouldn't necessarily write today. Some things I definitely wouldn't write today. And I put that away and stopped working on it, focused heavily on high fantasy. Moved over to doing the slave series about Balibray, and he's a gladiator that goes to war against the slave trade. That's the pitch that I always give at the conventions. Mm-hmm. And that was supposed to just be a single graphic novel. I had done like a little preview thing with him attacking some Martians, and it was like, why would this high fantasy character be attacking Martians? And I eventually wanted to work my way to explaining that, but I wrote Slave as a standalone story, and published it 72 pages, found an artist in Serbia that I was able to work with, and we got this thing published. And then I was getting good response from it, so I decided, hey, I need to come back and I need to do the rest of the story. I want to do, you know, 5 or 6 other graphic novels, continue it on. So I started writing Slave of the Depths and expanded upon it. Talked a little bit about this Wandering King character that I name drop in the first book, and kind of delve a little bit into that backstory, flesh out the world a little bit more, add some more mystical elements, because it's supposed to be a high fantasy book, but Slave is largely just sword and sandal. There's a Cyclops, and there's not really a lot else to it. You know, the main character's got some pointy ears and orange skin, but you know, it's not high fantasy. So I leaned into the high fantasy in the second book, and then, I finished that, I put it out, and I saw one of my friends who I had played D&D with, and Balibray was actually one of my old D&D characters. So I tend to reuse a lot of characters. If I make a character for a role-playing game and I like them, chances are they'll show up in my writing somewhere. Now, it won't necessarily be the same, like they won't go through the same plots, or they won't necessarily look the same, but they'll show up somewhere, somehow.
Sure.
So,
I was going to say, at a lot of conventions, if we didn't have people who were like taking their D&D characters and making them into stories, like we almost wouldn't have an author's alley at all. So, I mean, very common.
And you can't let a good character go to waste.
For sure.
So I had met with this friend. We were walking through First Friday. First Friday is a monthly art walk here in Las Vegas. And they have vendors come in. They set up. It's a lot of painting, live art, arts and crafts, all different kinds of things. There's a lot of food vendors. Sorry if I'm clicking my mouth a lot when I think of a point.
No, you're good.
Try to be cognizant of that. But I saw him there, and I wound up giving him copies of Slave and Slave of the Depths. And he came back to me later. And I had thanked him by name in the book after not seeing him for a number of years. And he was really touched by the fact that I had thanked him. So he wound up investing money into a third book.
Oh, wow.
And kind of kicked my ass in gear to get the third book going. It pushed me further down that path. And then later on, I wound up doing the fourth book and released that right at the beginning of, well, this is about the October into the first October during the pandemic. So I got 4 books now. I've got the script finished for the fifth book. I'm waiting for the money situation to be right in order to start production on the fifth book. I was saying this year, but it's probably more realistically going to be sometime next year. Mm-hmm. I've got a few irons in the fire for other stories and things that I want to produce right now. And it's looking more realistically like it'll be next year when we start production on that.
For sure.
So, I had worked my way through the high fantasy stuff, and started coming up with other ideas. And several years back, I had thought I wanted to do like an Adam Strange kind of character.
Okay.
Like space explorer, blasters, you know, Han shot first type of stuff. And really started to kind of kick around the idea of having this guy crash land on Earth in the Old West.
Okay.
Hey, the Old West, don't really know, but I thought the fun angle would be he crashes right before the Battle of Little Bighorn. Mm-hmm. And encounters Custer and gets swept up with all that. And that was just the seed that I had. And I was doing an in-store signing for Slave and Slave the Depth. So this tells you kind of how long ago I had the idea. It was like 2012. And I was doing the in-store signing, and this guy came in, and he was really, really rude to the manager who was working there. I didn't know her, but I could tell that his rudeness was based in the fact that she dared to be a manager in a comic book shop. Hmm. And it really didn't sit well with me. And I started to kind of like ruminate on it. And for whatever reason, I thought the right thing to do because of that situation, somehow that situation made me want to change this main character of my Western stuff over to a female character. Kind of wanted to I guess, put up some other voices there rather than just, you know, white male voices. I mean, Balibre essentially is a white male voice. I've heard him described in other ways. I've been told that he definitely reflects different cultures, but I still think of him in this white male space. I wanted to do different voices and decided to change him into her and wrote that story with her as a female character. Then I decided I wanted to give her a companion, you know, cause if I'm going with like Doctor Strange or Doctor Who kind of character, the Doctor always had a companion. So I brought in a character that I had used in True North. And we called him Eastwood. His real name was James Clay. I fleshed out his background more. He was the son of a rancher in Texas and ran afoul of Texas Rangers. And they killed him and his father, and he wasn't killed. I get into that. Well, I don't actually get into it. That's a story that I had. I had another plot twist writer write, but we get into the whole origin of him later on, but he winds up walking away from this execution basically of him and his father, and gets into the sideshow, and Biala, the main the alien that crash lands on Earth, meets him as he's working in the sideshow, and they wind up setting up a detective agency and going on adventures in the Old West. So that was the genesis of Weird Western Adventures.
Very cool.
Was, you know, I was working all these things at the same time, and now that, you know, I'm a few years down the road, it's like I'm writing other stories. I've been working on I did a rock and roll biography on Rob Halford in Fight for 10 Ton Press. I've been doing some other stuff that I won't get too into yet because it's not out yet, but I've been doing some other 10 Ton Press stuff. I've been writing a lot of my own stuff, writing other characters, and I decided I wanted to get back into True North. So I've actually been writing True North over again, rebooted it as a cyberpunk story. Uh-huh. It's a lot of genres at once. It's basically a superhero in the middle of a cyberpunk police procedural. If that makes any sense at all. It makes less sense to me, and I'm the one who wrote the damn thing. So it's going to be hard to pitch, I think.
Genre crossing stuff doesn't, not that weird. That's always with comics, right? Like, there's anything that you're into, there's probably a comic about it. So, specializing in something a little bit, like crossover into something else, might be meeting a need that, you know, no one else is doing. That's fun thing about making indie comics, right?
Absolutely. Just trying to find that niche that's not being hit. I mean, that's why I write so many things.
So I was going to ask you, like, so you were at you had a table at the FANEX convention, which is the local Utah convention 3-4 weeks ago, was?
You say local, and coming from Vegas, it's so much bigger than we did a show the week before. So much bigger than the show we did the week before here. Mm-hmm. Amazing. The one that you and I had met at back in 2017. Mm-hmm. It had to have been 6-7 times the size of our show.
It's a huge convention.
I think when you say local, that unless the listeners have been to it, I think that really kind of undersells how large Salt Lake really is.
It's an insane, the first year that they did it, you could tell the unmet demand here in Salt Lake was how big it was, because the fire marshal had to close down the building, had to stop people coming in and out and stuff. It was kind of a madhouse, and they've kind of kept up that pace over the last few years. But we can talk about that too in just a sec. But I wanted to ask you about, like, your process. Like, one of the things about indie comics is, like, you have to, you're a writer, right? So you don't actually, like, draw out the pages and stuff like that. You have to find people who are pencilers and inkers and letterers. You do some of the lettering, I think you told me off before we started. But any of the jobs that you don't do yourself, you've got to find somebody, right? So how do you do that?
So I need to say, music is a huge part of my process. I'd be remiss if I didn't bring that up. If you ever see my Instagram, I'm constantly posting about music. I write to music. I letter to music. I have added soundtracks to books. True North, I had a little caption at the bottom of most pages. If I thought a song fit the mood of the page, I'd put the artist and song title at the bottom of the page. Mm-hmm. So music is a very big part of what I do. Mm-hmm. That being said, I usually will sit down. If I have an idea for a script, I start with a sentence or two, and I put them all in a word document. Mm-hmm. Usually I use Google Docs, because I can pick that up anywhere. I can pick it up on my phone. I can pick it up on my laptop. I can pick it up on another laptop. I have it with me. It's portable. And I learned that having the portability and having the backup, I learned that after I lost a script for a horror book that I was working on, or a horror anthology that I was working on, and I still to this day haven't been able to go back and recreate that story. I know the basis of it. I mean, it's largely based on a classic Poe story involving two comedians. But I just haven't had it in me to go back and fix it. And part of it is, I guess, serendipitous that I didn't actually.
Oh, so you said you washed it. You literally put it in the wash and it disintegrated?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Okay. So what happened is I had it on an external hard drive. And apparently I dropped that external hard drive too many times and it just stopped working.
Gotcha.
And I lost it. That could be me, you know, me misspeaking. I lost the story and just couldn't get it back. Mentally couldn't summon up the story again in order to recreate it. A lot of it's still there in my head. I'll eventually get to it, but right now, I guess the time isn't right.
Gotcha.
One of the characters was loosely based on Louis C.K. anyways, and I don't need to touch that.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So do you have, I know, met a couple of friends of yours, James and Cubby, that were at the table with you. I know they're both artists, right? And so do you get work from like local friends and stuff like that to help out with your books? And then you also mentioned that you were working with an artist out of
Serbia.
Serbia, yeah.
And Romania. The guy who's working on the True North reboot is out of Romania.
Okay.
So I work a lot with James and Killian Cubstead. James Stone. I met them as a result of going to local artist meetups. Mm-hmm. They're local creators. They write their own stuff. They draw for anybody that has the money. Because I mean, quite frankly, everybody wants to get paid, and it's only fair. So, you can find artists fairly easily. I mean, I found them because I do the local shows. I found Alexander Bojic. He's the artist out of Serbia. I found him on the old digital webbing forums.
Okay, yeah, that was a great resource. I think they screwed around with the website and kind of lost their mojo.
I haven't been there in years. I've found that Instagram and Facebook can be nearly the resource that digital webbing is, especially if you're in the right Facebook groups or catch the right group of people on Instagram. Because I have picked up artists off of Instagram and Facebook to do projects, and I found that most of the time they're pretty easy to work with, and especially if you're in some kind of creators community, they have a bit of a reputation that they want to uphold. So they work towards that. They won't screw you over. And that's always a fear whenever you're entering into what is essentially a business partnership with a stranger online. They have a reputation that they want to uphold. You should have a reputation that you want to uphold, and you guys are trying to work together, trying to be as honest as possible with each other while creating a good product.
Right.
And for anybody that wants to do this, I can't stress enough, pay your artists when they expect to be paid. Mm-hmm. And personally, I like to pay the artists what they want to be paid. I don't really like to negotiate with artists. And I know that's kind of like a taboo thing, but I find that the quality of art that I get is better when I give the artist what they're asking for.
Certainly. It's the highest compliment I feel like that you can pay an artist is to pay them, actually pay them.
Yeah. Some people underbill themselves and that's unfortunate. And, you know, sometimes you can make that right, or you can just allow it to go. I mean, you shouldn't necessarily do that because you're going to want a good reputation as a writer.
Oh, sure. And if you're built like comic books is a collaborative art, right? So like you don't want the other person who's creating this, you know, experience and entertainment with you to feel like they've been taken advantage of. You'd like to, like you're making a series of comics. You're not just making one comic.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, if somebody walks away feeling that they got what's fair, you'll have such an easier time getting them back later. And if you need to work out some kind of weird deal with them, if they felt that you've been fair with them the whole time, chances are that they'll be fair back with you. I mean, you don't always want to bank on, well, I did the right thing, so you should do the right thing. But I mean, your chances are better when you're fair with somebody else.
Oh, sure. Well, and you got to look at the history of comic books, right? Like even at the big guys, they were not necessarily fair with their artists, and it was tragic, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot of people who came through. Yeah.
Those stories are legend. I mean, there's still people fighting over who got a fair shake and who didn't, even today. Sure.
Yeah, if you want, if listeners are interested, there's a book called The Untold Story of Marvel Comics, and it will tell you everything terrible that everyone who made all of your favorite Marvel comics did. And so, but the people who, like, did the good things, you will be a bigger fan of, but you will get the reality of like what really happened with the people who were in management and what really happened to like a lot of the artists and whatnot. And it's really sad. It's not the fun veneer that like the conventions have on them, right? It's there was like a gritty reality to what was essentially an entertainment business.
Yeah, it feels a lot like the Spider-Man origin in the Tobey Maguire movies, where he goes to get his money after the wrestling match, and the promoter cheats him out of it, and it feels a lot like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that a lot of people don't understand that the artists were getting they were getting kind of screwed over because their paychecks were also a contract at Marvel. So when they signed their check to actually put it into the bank, they were signing a contract that was signing away all of their rights to the artwork and all that sort of stuff, you know, and any sort of residuals that they were getting. It was a long time until people like Neil Adams were like actually standing up for the artists and demanding that they were getting more credit and more money for the things that they had created for Marvel. So, but my ears start itching that the fans of like Stan Lee and stuff are like outside my door.
Yeah, it's funny.
You know what I mean? So we'll skip that. There's another time. We always pitch every comic book convention we go to. We try to pitch like a, hey, here's the reality of Stan Lee. You know what I mean? Like, take the good with the bad. You know what I mean? And it always gets shot down because like, this is a place for people to come and have fun. They don't.
Yeah, I've got a friend who will fight that Stan Lee fight every time his name comes up, and I can't help but laugh. I mean, because there's nothing that can be done at this point.
Oh, sure. Well, and I mean, it's just history, you know what I mean? But it is, I feel like there is a thing to knowing the history and not doing it again.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, and not doing it myself, not being in that position. Yeah. The day I'm ever in a position like Stan Lee, though, you know what I mean? Like, oh my gosh, how cool would that be running something like that? But I digress. Get back to this. I desperately want to talk to you about conventions because I know you're a big fan and you've been to a ton of them, and you've even been to a ton of them recently.
Yeah,
way more than I have because COVID and whatnot. You know, the blip in reality that we had, where we had I skipped a whole bunch of them. But so you have been taking your comics, these indie books, so your own intellectual property, and you go to the comic book convention and then you sell them to one at a time, right? Like the books to people who come to the table. And so tell me about that experience. Like, what sort of reaction do you get from the fans who were there? Maybe they were there to meet like Stephen Atmel or something like that. Like, they had a celebrity they were trying to meet, or they'd come for like a Dragon Ball Z statue, and they're looking through the artist alley, and they come to you, and all of a sudden there's a book with a character they don't know in a setting they might not be familiar with.
So the hope is that they'll buy something. I mean, we have no guarantees when we go into these shows. You know, we might spend a couple to several $100 for an artist alley table or a booth. And there's no guarantee that you'll walk out of there ahead or even breaking even. You get a couple minutes with each person that if they walk up to your table, you get a couple minutes with them and you have to try to sell them on your product. Sometimes it's a sale of you, the personality. Sometimes it's a sale of the product. It really depends what the product is, what the pitch is, how interesting the product actually is. And sometimes people do buy just because there's a larger than life personality selling this to them. But you know, the process is pretty much the same for every show. You buy an artist alley table, usually through a registration process. Sometimes you're juried in, but you pay your due, and you load in usually day before the show, sometimes hours before the show. You set up your booth, And Travis and I kind of want to come back to this, but Travis Romney and I were talking about the psychology of setting up booths. And I think that is a key component to any artist alley or vendor table, is where the eye goes. And we were talking about, I was, you know, talking with my booth mates too, a lot about it while we were in Salt Lake. Like, what do people look at? And I have modified my booth nearly every show, because something works, something doesn't. And this is always a learning process, but I can come back to that. But you show opens, sometimes you'll have like an hour or something extra for VIPs, and they'll walk through. Show opens, you get, like I said, a minute or two to talk about your product, and you get a lot of people who are like, I'll come back. And if they ever do, then that's great. There's a lot of, I'll come back, and they don't come back. And that's okay too. Because they've seen your product. And if you're pushing a brand, they see your brand. And next time they walk through, or next show they go to, they go, you know what, I'm going to pick it up this time. I didn't last time. I forgot, or I ran out of money, or some reason they didn't pick up your book last time. Excuse me. And then today, you know, they're here, they want to buy your book. Right. So you're building a brand, you're building a reader base for your product or your art. You're building a fan base for your art. But yeah, you get just a couple minutes with each person. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're doing this over the course of generally 3 days, sometimes four, depending on the show. Some shows here are just one day, and those are madhouse shows. When you've got 6 hours to pack a whole show into, sometimes the money is just coming so quickly, or the people want to buy stuff because they only have, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours to do it, and it gets tough. But these people come in, and you have to remove ego from what you're doing, because it's very easy to get hurt when somebody walks by and they just kind of glance at your stuff or say, would you like to take a look? And they say no. And they just leave it at that. And it's just like, oh, that's abrupt and it hurts, but you've got to learn to not take it personally. Cause you know, they don't necessarily know what to say. Like when I walk through Artist Alley and somebody hits me with a pitch, I'm not there to buy anything. And it's like, well, how do I tactfully tell them no? And I, you know, I've been on both sides of it. So it's, I think, an important thing if you're looking to get into Artist Alley, to not take the no so personally.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I personally tend to try to stay out of the Artist Alley, like getting close to the tables if I can, appreciating from the, because I feel guilty for it. Cause like you said, I've been on the other side of the table there. So anybody that I engage with, I will usually end up buying something because I will, especially if I make a connection, you know, if it's someone that I feel, I'll usually ask where they're from and like, how they, how long, if they've been to Salt Lake before, if it's our artist's alley. And, so I end up, I will spend way too much money and, but that's okay. I always dig the art that I get when I come back. So New York Comic Con was this last weekend at the time of the recording, and sounded like it was a huge, I can't even imagine hitting that one up. You ever been to the New York one?
I haven't been anywhere east of Denver for a con yet.
Okay. So yeah, likewise, I went to the old Denver Comic Con before it was purchased by the Fan Expo folks. So it looked like it was nuts. Like just seeing the posts on Instagram and TikTok and whatnot, looks like it's a lot of fun. But there was an article that came out, I don't know if it was just before or let's see. Yeah, just before, is by, Rob, Salkowitz, who was the author of a book called, Comic-Con and the Business of, Pop Culture. And the article is called Are We Entering a New Era for Conventions? This was published on ICV2, if anybody wants to check this out. And one of the things that he was talking about is that you are seeing, at these conventions, you are seeing fewer big publishers. So like Marvel, DC, they're not having their own booths anymore. Some of the studios are having less or fewer and fewer tables at the conventions. So there's fewer announcements, big announcements about the movies and stuff. There are still a few, but not as many as there used to be. And like large scale exhibitors, people with huge booths that like big experience and stuff like that. And there was like Salt Lake FanX here in particular, that was sort of like their deal. And a lot of the Comic Cons over the last 15 years, their deal is every year more celebrities, bigger, more comics, more this, more that, you know, more vendors, more food, that sort of stuff. And I wanted to get your take on that. It seems like that is like slowing down and kind of changing. So like, what's been your perception of like the change of the conventions over the last few years?
So the last time I remember even seeing a publisher that wasn't like a very indie publisher was Source Point at LA Comic Con back at the end of last year. I don't remember seeing any of the, and when I say publishers, I mean somebody distributed by Diamond. I don't necessarily mean Marvel or DC, but you know, like
Dark Horse, Boom, any of the
Black Mask, Antarctic Press. That's what I mean when I say publishers. And the only one I remember seeing, I want to say, was Source Point at LA Comic Con.
Okay.
It feels like a lot of these conventions are becoming more the same, you know, doing Denver, doing Salt Lake, doing Vegas, doing LA. I'm seeing very similar layouts or very similar structures where you call in, and even we did Alien Con a few years ago, and that was one put on by not necessarily the History Channel, but it's the Ancient Aliens people. I think they might have their own separate group that put this on. Now they do like a traveling roadshow kind of thing. But it feels largely the same for all of these conventions where they come in and they have autograph opportunities. They have photo opportunities, which are awesome. But it feels like it's less about a comic experience and more about a fandom experience, which is great. And that's what some people are really looking for. But yeah, we're moving away from seeing traditional publishers there. We're seeing more indie people. You're seeing a lot of individual creators, especially artists, you know, like Jim Lee did Denver. I'm trying to remember who else was there. I mean, I've seen Neil Adams at, obviously not recently, but I've seen Neil Adams at these shows. I think Peach Momoko did New York Comic Con, and I don't know if there's any, if you know anything that happened with her.
As a matter of fact, I was looking up something on my phone while we were just sitting here talking. I just saw a post where they were apologizing for something.
I don't know what happened with her.
And I don't know what happened to
you. I'm kind of giving her as an example, like, you know, I'm seeing creators there, but not publishers. And it's frustrating as like an indie person, because it's like, you can't just walk down to the Aspen booth or the Oni Press booth and be like, I mean, you're not even supposed to do it anyways, but be like, here's my stuff, can you take a look at it?
Well, they used to have editors there, right? Like, I mean, this is like a long time ago.
When
you used to be able to like walk up with your portfolio and get a scathing, you know, like a portfolio review, and they'd reject you there in person, and you'd you know, get a stiff upper lip and go and try again the next year.
Yeah, and there's just so much less of that. Like, and that was, I think that still exists in San Diego. Admittedly, I haven't been to San Diego in several years. I stopped going because it was too much pop culture, not enough people buying books. You still see at every show, you still see the back issue bins, which I adore that those are still there. I mean, that's the basis of what a comic convention is actual comics. You still see a bunch of slabbed books, which are great. But then you've got, I hate throwing shade, but you've got like State Farm coming in and setting up a
book. Shade all you want, man. Like, I hate it when the insurance company's there, or like hot tub vendors and stuff like that. It's like, what are you doing here?
He mentions
in this article, it adds to the flea market feel of the convention, where it is, when you start losing some of those. Okay, so I'm going to back up a little bit on this, because people may not understand like the mechanics of the money at the convention. So what happens at a convention is that people like you and me, we go to the artist alley and we buy an artist alley table, or a vendor purchases a vendor table, right? Like, we get a break on it because what they want to encourage local and indie artists to come and be a part of the show, right? But vendors, people who are selling like the mock swords and the tons of pops and the like vintage action figures and stuff like that, they pay more for bigger space in the vendor area. And then all of that money gets gathered. So all that vendor stuff gets gathered, and that's how they pay for the celebrities. A celebrity comes to the show and they get paid a retainer, right? They have a minimum amount of money that they will show up for. And so say it's like $5,000 for somebody who like hasn't been on TV since the 60s. So they show up, they get $5,000. And then so if they take in money for the autographs and photos until they hit $5,000, any gap between what they make and $5,000, the convention has to pay, and they take it out of the vendor money. And so there's like, I always think of it in my head as a house of cards, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's that pool of money that pays for the celebrities, which a lot of times that's the celebrities is what a lot of people who come to the show, they're most interested in. And so they go to see celebrity. We're hoping as artists and vendors that you are going to stop on your way to go see the celebrity to maybe eke out a little bit more money on like some indie art and comics, maybe something from the vendors. So if big publishers who were paying millions of dollars for the booths that they used to pay for are not coming anymore, the shows have to make up that money somehow. Mm-hmm. And the way they're doing it is they're starting to invite insurance companies, food vendors, more knickknack type vendors and stuff like that, which rather than, you know, high quality collectible vendors. And so that all adds to that flea market garage sale feel that is starting to overtake some of the shows, because they've built these things up in Salt Lake. That is their number one thing to tell people, is like, hey, more celebrities than any other convention, which also they have probably the largest artist alley in the country.
Yeah, it was huge.
And they should, I feel like they should advertise that, but what they look at is the celebrities, because that's the most revenue generating thing, even though I feel like they should, you know, help out, like they should, and put a focus on the people who are helping with the pool of money to make the celebrities possible, right?
Yeah.
So, but like, is that a similar thing that you've been seeing around the country? I've been talking a lot.
I mean, I will say I don't necessarily think the artist alley is what's getting the feet through the door. It's definitely, you got all four hobbits together, or you got William Shatner in this city, and he was just in three other cities. People want to come see William Shatner. They want that experience. I've noticed that the guest lists have become very similar. The more shows that I'm doing, I have seen Shatner several, not in person, but I've seen Shatner on the bill several times for for, you know, saw him for Denver, I think he was in Salt Lake. He was in LA last year. He's going to be in LA this year. You start seeing a lot of the same celebrities, and I get it. People in different cities want to see these people. And that's what's driving the people through the door. And you have to respect that as an artist alley person.
Oh, sure. The whole thing is interconnected. It works together, but that's what I'm saying is, like, you have to be careful to make sure that all of the parts of the machine are running.
Rising tide raises all ships.
Yes.
You hope.
Yeah. 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 Not bagging on any one of these things. Like, to be clear about that, you know what I mean? Like, they all have to work.
Yeah, absolutely. But the conventions are starting to become more homogenous. I want to go to one of these East Coast conventions. I saw one that was set up in like an airplane hangar, and it's like, my nice. God, that must have been so cool. Like, just the ambiance of that. And it's like, you know, the light's probably not great. It might smell like oil, but I've seen one convention center. I've seen a dozen. I've seen three dozen convention centers. All end up looking the same inside. And every show, you know, they have their own show colors and they have their own show identity. But ultimately, there's going to be an artist alley. There's going to be a vendor area that probably has foam swords and Funko Pops. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a booth selling mystery boxes.
And oh, yeah.
They're at every show.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting to encounter something that really sets these apart, that really makes them special.
Sure.
And maybe it's me. Maybe it's because I'm really only going through Artist Alley, like really giving Artist Alley a heavy look, because, you know, I want people to see my booth. So I look at other booths that are like my booth.
Right.
You know, maybe because I'm standing behind a table, I'm not seeing what makes Denver Fan Expo different from LA. Mm-hmm. But like I said, lately they're starting to feel kind of the same.
Yeah. I've heard that from professionals as well that I am lucky enough to talk to every once in a while, where they say that they get to the show and they'll have been at a show like in Dubai or something like that. And mm-hmm. It'll be like, oh, wow, you went to Dubai for this? And they'll be like, it's the same view.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, nothing about it changes for me. I sit behind the table for 12 hours a day, you know, and talk to these people. And not that they don't appreciate the fans and all that sort of stuff, but for them, it's not, you know, oh, I vacationed in Dubai. It was like, I worked at another convention.
I worked in Dubai. And you just hope that there's something across the aisle from you, something interesting, like a guy in a gull costume.
Right.
Because without that, you just get so bored.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I hear that. Or if you're really close to the guys who have to play the really loud music so you can see the sound activated, like, items in their booth.
Is that what they're doing? Because I always hear the music and it makes me crazy. I never considered that maybe they're trying to sell something with the music.
I give those people, I give like a mile of slack, because it's like, you're showing your product. If people can't see those moving. No, the one that is loud music that's unnecessary is the people who do the temporary tattoos and the face painting.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's the same booth and they go to every show, and it's you got to see the ones there that are like the most lucrative things, because they've just made a career out of it. Right. Mm-hmm. Like the people who are selling the like bootleg Legos.
Yeah.
That has to be like that is such a moneymaker. Oh, you know what I mean?
The foam weapons. I heard a story about how these guys, and this is all rumor, this is all hearsay.
Sure. Yeah. Take it with a grain of salt.
That, you know, they had like 12 booths in Denver. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was that high. It was probably like 6 or 8.
Sure.
All under different names. And what they do is they get a storage unit in each city and they ship their product to the storage units, and they're not traveling with this product. They have enough product on hand in each city that they can fully stock all of these booths. And then they individually just travel to where they need to go. So that's where they do all these shows. That's the rumor that I had heard. Now, I didn't talk to any of them directly, so I couldn't, even if I had, I probably they wouldn't have verified that with me, but yeah, right. that's the kind of thing that I had heard about that, which is interesting.
People will find the way to work these systems, right? And so what I think these, like you were saying, like the homogeny of the shows, it's also playing to the fact, well, hang on, before we move on from Swords, I can tell you my lived experience from the last convention with a sword dealer. My son bought one. That's his favorite thing to go get is the fake swords, right? Mm-hmm. And so I get it. They get it from their favorite anime, and it's very particular of like which ones they can get and all that. That's great. That was me. You know what I mean? Like I ran to the baseball card shops and shows, and I needed, you know, the 89 Don Mattingly or whatever.
Yeah.
So helping him with that, having that experience for him, I'm thrilled to be a part of that. So he bought the one from the character that he wanted. The guy opened the box, like showed it to us from one angle, right? Closed it. My kid walked around with this box the rest of the day. It was the first thing that he bought. We were there for like 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And he carried it around with him the whole day. Mm-hmm. At the very end of the day, we went and saw a friend's panel that went over the closing time, so we couldn't go back onto the floor or anything like that. He finally actually opens it up, takes the whole sword out. It's broken.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it had a huge 2-inch gash, but it was like on the bottom side of the sword. And so the sheath that it was in had like a hole in it. And my kid was a trooper about it. He was like, oh, you know, but I could tell it was like really disappointing for him. And so that might've been a one-off. I didn't get a chance to talk to him. There's no way I'm going to come the next day and be like, hey, look, it broke it. And they're gonna be like, yeah, right. You know what I mean? But the other thing, we looked at that shop and my other son wanted one that was from a book called Berserk. It's a big sword. They had one there. And so my son goes up and asks how much it was. And this is a big sword, you know what I mean? It's like, if you've ever read Berserk, it's like it's this iconic sword that he carries around. It looks a lot like Cloud's from Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. It's way too wide, like a tiny little handle anime sword, right? Dude wanted $800 for it.
$800?
I was like, are you serious? Like, I would have...
Say three. Wow.
Yeah. No, $800. $300 is what I would expect a starting point to be. And then talk him down to $225.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is what I... And maybe I just missed the boat on the recent inflation and stuff like that, which has been a huge...
I couldn't wrap my head around it.
It's crazy going out. But yeah, but that was nuts. I was like, yeah, the sword guys, that thing couldn't have cost more than $10. And you go and look at... you look at where their sources are from, like on Alibaba or whatever, you know what I mean? You can find those swords. You can get them yourself from the distributors if you know where to look. That's not the fun con experience, though, right? Mm-hmm. Like coming back with like a cool costume weapon or your favorite comic book or your favorite pop or whatever. You know, I could buy any of that stuff off of Amazon. That's not the fun.
No wonder they have the money to buy these storage units.
And that's the thing, is like the profit margins on some of this stuff is just insane. And it's what's so like, you and I do IP. I do a little bit of fan art, you know what I mean? Because, it's just good money. You know what I mean? And I can see the trap of it, like doing your whole booth that way, you know, like I talk to people who are there where like, if I eke out enough money to pay for the table and some food, you know what I mean? I'm pretty happy because people are buying stuff that I made. But I know print guys who show up to that thing, they'll get two tables. And if they don't come home with like $5,000, they're like really disappointed.
Yeah. It's a weird balance, and not everything works the same for everyone. It's not one size fits all. Because I've talked to Killian and James about having more fan art, and Killian doesn't necessarily want to go down that road with doing fan art. He wants to promote our own IPs, and I respect that.
Sure.
But I also want to make money. And I think there's something about finding that balance of like, what is comfortable for you selling fan art versus your own IPs. Some people do 50-50. Some people do no creator IPs, and it's all fan art. Some people only do creator IPs. And I you'll see a wide range. It can be described best as a spectrum of fan art to creator owned material. And right. It's tough to figure out what that sweet spot is for you.
Yeah. The thing that we were talking about earlier, the thing that I've noticed is that those endeavors, though, where it is working for the person that sells prints, they are much more able to purchase more tables, which mm-hmm. chokes out, you know, people who are trying to do their own IP. And the con doesn't care about this, you know what I mean? Like they don't care about like the smaller politics, not politics, but whatever, like the little guys, you know what I mean? Like the $150 for the table is kind of a rounding error for the convention as a whole, right? That's just not something that they're looking into. But it is one of those things where it'd be like, you know, if I'm coming in and I make, you know, $100 at the show, not even make, you know, like I bring in $150 and I spent $150 to be there all weekend. That's a huge difference from a guy who comes in and pays for a table and made $5,000.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it feels like there should maybe be like a second tier to the artist alley, you know, where it's like, here's who we invited because we feel bad for them. And that's us, right? Yeah. look at these poor artists trying to build their own IP. You know, I think that some conventions do that through their judging process.
So you can get, and I will get into this judging process thing, a wish list for the judging process, if you will. You will see wildly different booth layouts. And part of it is the guys that sell prints tend to have much larger vertical booths. Sometimes they have horizontal booths. And when I say horizontal, I mean they come closer and closer to the aisle. And that's something over the last couple of
years. They're building like a little apartment for themselves. They're
building
with walls.
It's a what are those? There was a particular kind of Japanese dining experience, and I could not find the name of it, but it feels like a library carol where you're just sitting there and you're just surrounded by walls and you don't see anybody but like what's right in front of you. The animatronic fortune tellers where you're just sitting in a booth. And you're selling your stuff, people will put up these walls of prints on either side of them, and it makes it hard to see down the aisles. This is something I was complaining about with Denver, and I was really upset because I was victim's not the right word, but I encountered it in the booth next to ours, and it really blocked our sight lines. And I saw it in Salt Lake, not at my table. I want to say in Salt Lake, the neighbors on both sides of me were excellent. Awesome. They were both pleasant, and they had displays that I thought took good. They made good use of the space, and they didn't intrude on other people's space. So I will say that was not the case for me in Salt Lake, but I did see it elsewhere, where the print people will have their prints all the way to the front of their table, and you can't see around it. And I feel bad because, you know, they'll be the second in from the end and you can't see the guy on the end because of them. Mm-hmm. And these displays are getting bigger. It used to be they had the 16-foot wall of prints, and now it's closing in. The wall of prints doesn't bother me as much unless they start putting it on the back and now you're seeing some.
Oh, and it's confusing stuff. Whose booth it is because the people behind are like, oh, where's your prints? And it's like, oh, it's the dude on the other side.
Yeah. But that's the only time the big wall of prints really has ever stuck out to me. But yeah, you're seeing a lot of that. And I get it. People have a lot of prints. They want to maximize the use of their space. The convention show management isn't really enforcing the convention rules that say like you can't go over 8 foot or you can't have a booth that extends or you can't have sidewalls, I think is specifically what Denver said. And meanwhile, they do. And it's like, you know, you go and you can complain and something might get done or it might not. Or you can say something to the person, and that's always a minefield because you got to be next to this person for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And you've thrown shade at him, and now you're stuck next to him. So do you say something to him? Do you let it go and and let your sales potentially suffer. I mean, really, ideally, you should be able to overcome any kind of obstacle like that. But it's not always the case. I know sometimes I've gone into shows where it's like something bad happened in the beginning, and now I've got a grumpy look on my face the whole weekend, and it's not a good thing for me.
Right.
So I like to try to mitigate that stuff very early on. Luckily, Salt Lake was good.
It is kind of the luck of the draw. It is. I do the same thing. Try to like be a good booth neighbor, be cognizant of what people are wanting to do around us. I think it's kind of rough when you're next to someone who has like a really hard sales pitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a guy in Vegas that was he was a self-published author, and he sold every book that he had, but man, it was a hard sell, and so it was rough for us.
I think I know who you're talking about, because there is a guy that we've seen, and we saw him in LA the last time we were in LA. Mm-hmm. And it's like, holy shit, he still has
you're fine, you can swear.
He still has the same pitch.
And that's a perfect pitch.
Like, memorize. Was it?
Oh yeah.
Can I just give a little hint at what it was to see if we're on the same page?
Yeah. Oh, I can tell you exactly what it was. I could set my watch to it. My dad never been to a comic book convention ever in his life. He's a classic car guy.
Yeah.
And one time I said, hey, we're going to do this. I'm going to do this. That's when we met I came with my dad. And yeah, you met him. He's a great guy. He made friends with John Romita Jr. by waiting in line. He was like the second dude in line. So he made friends with everyone around him, and they were handing him comics and stuff, because he's like, oh, I'm just standing here, to be in line for my son. But yeah, the guy next to us, if cosplayers walked by, he'd ask to take their picture.
Okay.
And then he would take a picture, and then they'd be like, he'd like, thank you. And they'd say, you're welcome. And then he'd be like, oh, hang on, come and look at the picture. It turned out really good.
Hmm.
And then they would come over, and they'd be like, yes, that did turn out very nice. And he's like, oh my gosh, here's my card. I'm going to post this on Instagram later, and you can get a copy of your photo from here. While you're waiting, here's my book. And then, or if they walked by, he'd be like, what do you like to read? And anything that they said that they like to read, mm-hmm. that's what his book was about.
Yeah.
I like this. Oh, I like Lord of the Rings. It's exactly like that. I like Gremlins. Oh, it's exactly like that, you know? And then if he handed you the book, he'd never touch it again. If he could help it.
That's a psychological thing. And yeah. I definitely know, put it in people's hands. It's pushing.
Oh, sure. I don't mind people looking, and you know what I mean? Like, and it's the thing is like, it's like speeding on the freeway, right? Like anybody faster than me is a maniac, and anybody slower than me is a dumbass.
Yep.
And that's the same thing, but.
No, I remember there was a guy that his was based around television. And it was interesting, but my God, I heard it so many times one weekend.
That's the other thing is like, if you need to, we're getting like into the nitty gritty of actually having a artist alley table. But I remember another dear friend of mine, Stephen Crow, used to teach with at Broadview University, a fantastic artist working on Master of the Universe right now. He would tell the students, if you're going to have an artist alley table and you have a pitch, for the love of everyone sitting around you for 3-4 days, please vary the pitch a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't tell the same pitch over and over again in the same tone of voice over and over again. It is fingernails on a chalkboard for everyone around you.
Or have different things so you can give different pitches. That was – so one of the panels – and. Salt Lake, I sat in on more panels than I had ever sat in on before.
Okay.
Part of it was because of you guys.
No, it was great to always have you there. That was fun. We need to get you on some of them.
I would love to. Nobody ever asks me to be on panels. I would absolutely adore it. I sat on a couple of the business end of things that's so much fun. Not really. But they were talking about only working within one genre. And I get that. Like when you're starting out, you shouldn't spread your wings too far. You got to really work on what you're focused on in the beginning. But my God, you will get so bored if you stick to one genre for your entire career. And your table neighbors will absolutely friggin' hate you when you pitch the same book over and over and over again. So like I'm blessed to have, you know, two booth mates, generally two booth mates. Sometimes we get two tables and it's like four or five of us back there and we take turns. But like I'm part of a larger publishing company. So you know, we've got slice of life books. Like one of the ones that we talk about is a book about body positivity. Jean Munson took 2 years working on this book. She had been contemplating it for years before that, but she'd been working on this book Stretch Marks for 2 years. So I'll pitch that, or I'll pitch, we have a children's anthology, which was, you know, I can go into that and the process of that, but it's a children's anthology. It's about a magic tome. Or, you know, we got James's superhero book, which is about, this superhero that establishes a fishing village in a long time ago. And I still got to get the numbers down. Like, is it the 1800s? And, he establishes this fishing village and he goes away on adventures and he comes back and now it's this megalopolis and, it's just overrun with other superheroes and supervillains and he's got to try to get the city whipped into shape. And then I got my book. It's about a gladiator that goes to war against the slave trade. It's four issues. And you know, like you start doing all of these different pitches and it gets better. And yeah, it's a lot to remember, but having the varied thing, different books, you grab different people with different things. I didn't sell a single fantasy book in Salt Lake, not one. The only ones that I did sell were to the stores when I went beforehand. Everything I sold was Weird West.
That seems like the audience out here. They're into that. So I knew those books would do well.
Yeah, and I mean that one. Sometimes you just say, "Oh, it's a Weird Western anthology," and they're like, "Weird West, let's see it." And sometimes you got to like really hype it up. Like it's about an alien that crash lands on Earth who opens a detective agency with an immortal. And I don't use that voice when I give the pitch, but.
You should. It's a good
one. I should. It's very sarcastic and it's like, oh, well, I would like to see that.
You know, next time we do this, we got to get James and Cubby maybe to come and tell us a little bit of the fun side of what's going on your books and whatnot.
Cubby will blow out anybody's earphones. I just want to warn that he has the loudest, deepest voice. I don't understand how anybody can talk like that. And we give him such a hard time about it all the time.
You guys were a lot of fun. We hung out. We got to hang out a little bit outside of the convention, which was a really good time. And actually went to the restaurant Cubby's because of the namesake. You guys insistent.
We gave
him it was pretty good.
A hard time. I do want to say you guys aren't slouches yourself in the fun department. But yeah. We gave him such a hard time about that restaurant name, and it's like, we have to go there. So we were going to go there on the way out of town, which I'm glad we went Saturday night because they were all closed, I guess, Sunday. Yep. I don't understand this closing on Sunday stuff. Right. But
yeah, they roll up the sidewalks here on Saturday night, so yeah, you were lucky you didn't get caught into that.
Yeah.
But I've lost the complete track of time here because we've been having such a fun conversation, but we're going to wrap it up here. For all the folks at home who now are big fans of all of the books, where can they keep up with you and what conventions you're going to be at?
So the easiest way to find me is at studiostellapolaris.com. It has links to all my social media, but you can find me on Instagram at Studio Stella Polaris, no underscores or hyphens or any of that. My next few shows are going to be Unicon here in Las Vegas at the World Market Center downtown. That same weekend, we're doing Vegas Valley Comic Book Festival in the Clark County Library, like Flamingo and Maryland Parkway. And then at the beginning of December, we're doing LA Comic Con at the LA Convention Center. We don't have any of our 2023 dates lined up yet, but we'll be around. And I'm 99.999% sure that we're going to try to get in on Salt Lake again. I hadn't I hadn't committed to it before because it's like, oh, it's such a far drive. Maybe I'll do it every 2 years. But that 6 hour drive honestly went by so fast.
And it's not a bad drive.
We had such a good time.
That my parents, it's their favorite vacation to go to Las Vegas, and I've done it many times. And so, it's not a bad drive, but I hear you. And we're super planning on hitting the Las Vegas one this next coming up one. So
yeah, I can't wait to see you guys out here again. I've been cooking up ideas for what we can do in the off hours.
That'll be a good time. So. Cool, man. Well, thank you so much, Greg, for hanging out with me tonight and telling me about all your great comics. Hopefully the listeners get a chance to go to your website, check it out, and pick a couple up themselves, and maybe even meet up with you at one of the comic cons and say hi in person.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Hopefully I didn't ramble too much about stuff people didn't care about.
No, that's a podcast, man. That's how these roll. So awesome. Thank you very much for listening to the Lane Urich Report, and we'll see you next time.